Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, celebrating over 70 years of service to financial advisors, their clients, and institutions worldwide. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
AAA to junk. Bond ratings get things going for us today. BP asks for help. And hey, look what I bought. Social shopping, sharing your purchases online. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. And by Reputation Defender, helping doctors, lawyers, and small business owners monitor, protect, and improve their online reputations. ReputationDefender.com/market.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Wednesday today, the 2nd of June, and it is great to have you with us. We had an interesting and revealing moment on the broadcast yesterday. I was talking to Alan Greenberg, the former chairman and CEO of Bear Stearns, and I asked him how in the world he and all the other people who'd spent their lives on Wall Street wound up buying into mortgage-backed securities that were worth little more than the paper they were printed on. Here's part of what he said.
I think really, Kai, the big mistake was that Bear Stearns was highly leveraged, and we were under the impression we owned AAA securities because those AAA securities, you know, weren't AAA. In a very short period of time, they went down to 50 or 60 cents on the dollar.
Those bonds were AAA because the ratings agencies, Fitch, Standard & Poor's, and Moody's, said they were. Those companies and the ratings that Mr. Greenberg and his colleagues relied on were topic A at a Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission hearing today. Remember, that's the panel that's supposed to tell us by December what caused the finance market meltdown of the past couple of years.
This is a very challenging topic because the entire investment universe uses the ratings agencies.
That's Guy Labat. He handles fixed income strategy for Janney Montgomery Scott in New York. And his point is an important one, that in the debt crisis we are still working our way out of, everybody in the debt markets had to use the ratings agencies. Even a guy you've probably heard of, Warren Buffett, the star witness at today's hearing.
It makes for a wonderful economic model.
That helps explain why Buffett owns 13% of Moody's, but it doesn't mean he has to like it. Buffett and anybody else who issues debt, and a lot of institutional investors who buy that debt, have to have a rating agency seal of approval.
I need a Moody's rating and a Standard & Poor's rating. I need both of them. It's required in many cases by the rules under which our life insurance company operates or our property casualty company. So if they say to me my bill is $1 billion, and I say, gee, you know, I'd like it to be $900,000, or I'll go down the street. Essentially, there is no down the street.
Buffett, for what it's worth, says he doesn't use agency ratings when he's making investments for his holding company, Berkshire Hathaway. And a lot of other big investors do their risk management due diligence in-house as well. Others, though, like Mr. Greenberg and Bear Stearns, trusted the ratings agencies, flaws and all. Jill Fish is professor of law at the University of Pennsylvania, where she directs the Institute for Law and Economics.
There isn't very much accountability for rating agencies right now. People have tried suing for years, claiming that the rating agency didn't do a good investigation, claiming that they lied and so forth. And by and large, courts have held that the rating agencies are not subject to liability.
Congress is working on some fixes as part of the financial reform bill, which may change things. But the panel today had only questions. Like, why do the big three ratings agencies have all the power? Can't that be spread out a little bit? And also, who can you trust if you can't trust the raters? The answers will come in December when the commission issues its report. But we called an actual bond trader today, Mike Hatley, the president of Westgate Horizons here in Los Angeles, to ask one more thing, whether the rating system can go on the way it is.
I would say, yeah, we probably could. It's hard to envision a scenario where they get it so wrong again.
The rating on Wall Street today was, let's say AA+. Bonds fell, stocks rose. Details when we do the numbers. $5 Vice President Joe Biden was at the Brooklyn Bridge today. He was talking about a stimulus project to rehab the 117-year-old bridge between Brooklyn and Manhattan. The Obama administration's $787 billion economic pick-me-up is more than a year old now. You pair that with news today that home sales were up as people rushed to take advantage of an expiring tax credit. And we got to wondering how much stimulus might be left out there. Marketplace's Jeremy Hobson takes a look.
The White House says 80% of the stimulus funds have been allocated, but the vice president's chief economist, Jared Bernstein, says just three quarters of stimulus funds will have been spent by the end of the year.
This summer, for example, we're going to see a lot more projects, but also I think we'll see a real ramp up in some of the more innovative investment side of the Recovery Act.
Bernstein says that's because while early stimulus funds went directly to states, tax cuts and entitlement programs, many long-term investments in energy, healthcare and infrastructure are only now getting underway.
A lot of those applications had to come in over the first year of the act, be carefully evaluated, and you're going to see a continuing ramp up of those in coming months.
The White House says this summer could be the biggest stimulus spending season yet. But Mark Zandi, chief economist at Moody's Analytics, says that doesn't mean it will have the biggest economic impact.
Well, what really matters to the economy is the change in the stimulus spend out. So we went from no stimulus in the beginning of 2009 to $80, $90 billion a quarter. It's that change that matters for economic growth.
And for that reason, he says, a rapid drop-off in stimulus spending could actually hurt the recovery.
The trick now is to allow the stimulus to fade, but to fade slowly enough that it doesn't undermine the economic expansion.
The White House will have to focus on that later this year when the stimulus begins to ramp down. In New York, I'm Jeremy Hobson for Marketplace.
Cell phone billing plans are famous for their complexity, but there has been one relative constant out there, the unlimited data plan. All the bytes that smartphone users can upload or download for one flat monthly fee. Well, you can toss that one on the scrap heap of billing innovation. Today, AT&T announced it's getting rid of its unlimited plan starting next week. That means all the zillions of new iPhone and iPad users are going to have to limit their data flow or pay for the extra. We asked Jeff Horowitz to find out whether other carriers might follow that lead.
Suppose you want to download an episode of Lost on your iPhone.
I love you so much.
No! No, no, my God!
AT&T's biggest new plan costs $25 a month for 2 gigabytes of data. That's a little more than one episode of Lost. Each additional gig is another $10. The caps only apply to data transferred over 3G or other cell phone networks. Downloading Lost over Wi-Fi still won't cost you a thing. But people are using their unlimited 3G data plans for things like video and large file transfers, which is clogging AT&T's system.
AT&T's network has been struggling with the iPhone for years now.
Larry Dignan, editor-in-chief at ZDNet, says giving people an incentive to limit their data could make the overall network more reliable. He says unlimited data was a nice perk, but spreading smartphone use makes it unsustainable.
My hunch is that, Verizon's probably going to follow suit, and there are going to be other companies that come out with caps along those lines.
Dignan never hits AT&T's new 2-gig limit with his iPhone, but Armin Papshev passes it every month. Papshev edits the blog iSmashPhone.com. He says making users timid about how much data they use could keep them from trying and inventing new things that use a lot of bandwidth.
Maybe you have to cater to some of the kind of early adopters, hardcore users who actually, push the technology.
AT&T says right now only 2% of customers use more than 2 gigs a month. People who use less stand to save money under the new plans. I'm Jeff Horwich for Marketplace.
Even if you're not big on reading food labels, you know high fructose corn syrup. The sweetener has gotten a lot of bad publicity as nutrition talk has turned to the obesity epidemic. Well, today comes news from the Department of Agriculture that production of high fructose corn syrup has been falling for the past several years. We are not getting any thinner as a population, so what's up? From the Marketplace Health Desk at WHYY in Philadelphia, Gregory Warner reports.
The smell of desperation seemed to waft out of the high fructose camp last year when the Corn Refiners Association launched a series of television ads to defend their product.
That it's made from corn, has the same calories as sugar, honey, and it's fine in moderation.
A lot of moderation, apparently. Production of the ubiquitous sweetener dropped 11% between 2003 and 2008. Audrey Erickson is with the Corn Refiners Association.
consumers are consuming more bottled water. They're consuming more diet drinks. In that case, they're not consuming sugar or our sugar made from corn, high fructose corn syrup.
But while the use of corn syrup fell, use of refined sugar rose by 7%. Products like Hunt's Ketchup and Gatorade have loudly switched over to sugar. Even soda companies, which pioneered the use of high fructose corn syrup, are testing sugar-sweetened versions. Jeff Saxon is with Participant Media, which produced Food Inc., a movie about processed food. He says the trend away from high fructose is a victory for popular media.
When you hear the same thing over and over again, or the same question raised, eventually people start to pay attention to this.
Claudia Polsky is an environmental lawyer in California who works on food labeling. She credits nutrition labeling laws.
I mean, you could have 50 articles about the dangers of high fructose corn syrup, and if nobody can figure out which product it's in, it's not going to affect them. I mean, nobody's going to go to a deformulation lab to take apart a bag of Hi-Hos.
Now analysts say more products with high fructose corn syrup are showing up overseas. In Philadelphia, I'm Gregory Warner for Marketplace.
Okay, so try this on as a stimulus package. Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez has been pouring hundreds of millions of dollars into social programs like free healthcare clinics and subsidized food stores for more than a decade. He can do that because, first of all, he holds most of the political cards down there, but also because Venezuela is South America's biggest oil producer. Oil revenues are falling, though, sharply. And with elections coming up in September, Mr. Chavez could have something of a problem. From Caracas, Reese Ehrlich reports.
Here in the poor barrio of La Vega, residents wait patiently in line at the local Mercal, a government-subsidized food market. Day laborer Delicia Abroacho says by shopping here, she saves about 20% of what she would spend at a regular supermarket.
I think Chavez is doing good things here. The Mercal is great for this country.
The Venezuelan government says such programs have helped reduce the poverty rate by two-thirds since Chavez was elected. He's diverted revenues from oil production to pay for social programs. But over the past 2 years, such revenues have dropped by 67%, creating a big budget deficit. Nora Castaneda, president of a government-owned bank, says the government won't balance the budget on the backs of the poor.
El presidente ha planteado.
Our president said that even if oil drops to zero, we will not adopt neoliberal policies or those handed down from the IMF and the World Bank. Our policies will never favor capital over the people of Venezuela.
But opposition activists say the cost of the social programs is no longer sustainable. Inflation is running at 30% so far this year, one of the highest rates in the world. Self-described anti-Chavez political activist Rafael Enrique Berroes sharply criticizes the government for creating rampant inflation.
Before, we ate well and lived well. Now we have more money in our pockets, but everything costs more. So the quality of life is worse.
Enrique Berroes says government mismanagement has also led to electricity brownouts, water shortages, and increased crime. The opposition plans to make the economy the major issue in this September's parliamentary elections. Pablo Medina is a leading opposition candidate for the National Assembly.
There is a big possibility that the opposition will win the parliamentary elections. It's the beginning of the end for Chavez.
Well, maybe. The government is confident it can improve economic conditions before September. Chavez increased the minimum wage by 25%, which should help galvanize support from the poor. Here at a pro-Chavez rally in Caracas, Cristina Gonzalez, who cleans rooms for a living, says, sure, there are water and electricity shortages. But she also points out that inflation is lower today than before Chavez was elected. Back in the mid-1990s, it peaked at 100% a year. Gonzalez says she and everyone she knows will vote for President Chavez's political party in September.
Today, we enjoy benefits we didn't have before. We enjoy Social Security and can get cheap loans. House cleaners now get pensions. We get free medical care. Our president has always defended the working class, the least protected.
Upper-income Venezuelans say that's just the problem. Chavez focuses disproportionately on the poor while ignoring inflation and alienating the very business interests who could pull the country out of crisis. In Caracas, I'm Reese Ehrlich for Marketplace.
Coming up, why some shoppers like to make their purchases public.
Then you can continue to spend your money on whatever the hell you like and feel good about yourself.
But first, let's do the numbers. Some encouraging economic signals helped the Dow Industrials bounce back by 225 points today, 2.25%. Blue chips finished at 10,249. The NASDAQ regained 58 points, nearly 2.75%. Closed at 2281. The S&P 500 rallied 27 points, better than 2.5%. Wrapped up trading at 1,098. Airline shares took off today after Continental's monthly revenue beat analyst estimates. Stock in the Houston-based carrier soared more than 11%. Rival airlines went along for the ride. United shares climbed a lofty 12.5%. BP may not be succeeding in plugging its big leak, but the oil giant did manage to reverse the steady decline of its stock value. U.S. traded shares rebounded more than 3% today. Bond prices declined, lifted the 10-year T-note to 3.34%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Progressive Insurance, with more than 30,000 local independent agents. Information available at progressive.com. What does setting interest rates have in common with driving a car? Visit the Marketplace whiteboard to find out. Our videos demystify finance and economics. Just go to our website, marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Thursday. In Washington, the Labor Department releases revised productivity and costs for the first quarter. Chain stores are scheduled to report sales figures for May. And 273 kids compete in day two of the Scripps National Spelling Bee. Last year's winning word was Laodicean, capital L-A-O-D-I-C-E-A-N. And go look it up. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. 5,000 feet under the Gulf of Mexico, a diamond-bladed saw spent most of the day stuck inside an oil pipe. BP's latest try at controlling the leak hit a snag when the saw did the same thing this morning. They did work it loose late this afternoon. Up on the surface, meanwhile, oil is now said to be visible near beaches in the Florida Panhandle. 6 weeks in, BP and the federal government have started accepting some international help in cleaning things up. Sophisticated oil skimmers from the Netherlands will soon be at work down in the Gulf. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer explains what took so long.
The Dutch technology involves giant skimmers attached to large ships. They suck in a combination of oil and water. They separate the two and spit the water back out. Ships fitted with the skimmers will head out from Houston soon. Why did it take so long? David Kotak is with Cumberland Advisors. He says neither BP nor the Obama administration realized at first just how bad the spill was.
It takes a huge shock to wake people up. And this is a systemic problem. And we did not think of it in systemic risk terms.
In other words, everybody missed the big picture. Stephen Shork edits the Shork Report, an energy newsletter. He says there's another problem for the government and BP.
Look, they are being inundated with ideas and techniques, and we have to make sure that the cure is not worse than the illness at this point.
Plus, you have to be sure these techniques don't conflict with government regulations. Bruce Johnson is a professor emeritus of oceanic engineering at the U.S. Naval Academy. He says there's a rule that doesn't allow contaminated water to be discharged back into the ocean. The Dutch skimming system doesn't quite remove all of the oil. But Johnson says so much oil is spilling out, that's okay.
My point is, if you could collect 80% of it and even discharge 5% back in, you're still way ahead of the game.
And pretty soon, this could be a global game as the spill spreads out into international waters. Countries like Cuba that border the Gulf of Mexico are watching the spill's progress anxiously. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall Genzer for Marketplace.
As the political pressure over the oil leak piles up on President Obama, his administration is leaning on BP. Attorney General Eric Holder announced a criminal investigation yesterday. Today, in the middle of a high-profile economic speech in Pittsburgh, the president threw in a few pointed lines about oil companies taking dangerous shortcuts. Commentator Robert Reich says that is all a fine start, but the White House needs to go one very big step further.
It's time for the federal government to put BP's North American subsidiary into temporary receivership. This would give President Obama authority to manage BP's operations in the Gulf until the gusher is stopped. The administration says BP must be in charge because it has the necessary equipment and expertise. The problem is BP is not accountable to the public. Its primary responsibility is to its own shareholders. Under temporary receivership, BP would still have the equipment and expertise, but it would unambiguously be working in the public's interest. That's the only way the public can be confident it's getting the truth. BP has continuously and dramatically understated the size of the gusher. Even in the last few days, BP chief Tony Hayward has tried to refute reports from scientists that vast amounts of oil from the spill are spreading underwater. Receivership would also ensure the public that BP is putting enough resources behind stopping the leak. The company now says it can't be stopped until August, when its new relief well reaches the gushing wellbore. But do we really have to wait until August? As of now, the government has no authority to force BP to do anything. Last Saturday, the administration expressed grave concerns about BP's attempt to cap the well with a process known as Topkill. It worried the technique would worsen the leak, and BP halted the effort. But expressing grave concerns is not enough. The president needs legal authority to order BP to protect the United States. If the government can take over giant global insurer AIG and the auto giant General Motors and replace their CEOs in order to keep them financially solvent, it should be able to put BP's North American operations into temporary receivership in order to stop one of the worst environmental disasters in U.S. history. No president would allow a nuclear reactor owned by a private for-profit company to melt down in the United States while remaining under the direct control of that company. The meltdown in the Gulf is the environmental equivalent.
Robert Reich is a professor of public policy at the University of California, Berkeley. Send us your thoughts. Our website is marketplace.org. Click on that link that says contact. The internet has done crazy things to the world of retail, far, far beyond just shopping online. There was the unboxing craze of a couple of years ago, countless YouTube videos of people taking their iPhone or a new TV or whatever it was out of its box. Now there is something called social shopping. Used to be when you were excited about something you'd bought, you'd show your friends in person. The new thing, apparently, is to share your purchases virtually, as in online. Websites are popping up all over. And other shoppers aren't the only ones paying attention, as Sally Herships reports.
Have you seen the new social shopping sites like Blippi or Swipely.com? They're like Facebook for people who are really into shopping. I wanted to check them out, so I joined Swipely. Okay, sign up now. The sites let you see what other people buy and sometimes where they bought it and what it cost. When I logged in, I saw pictures from Angus Davis, Swipely's founder. He bought some nautically themed pillows for his guest room. Another Swipely employee seems to be a big fan of Starbucks.
Wow, he buys a lot of coffee.
Here's how it works. You give your email account or your credit card number to the website. Then, when you buy something online and get emailed a receipt, or use your credit card, your purchase gets posted to your profile.
I am actually going to post my purchase of a toner cartridge for my laser printer.
Yeah, I'm not really a big shopper. We are in the middle of a recession. So I asked Rachel Laws why people use these sites. Laws studies consumer behavior and says the sites look a lot like Facebook, so they're familiar. They're also fun. And Laws says when you post your purchases, you feel responsible, like you're keeping better track of your money.
Then you can continue to spend your money on whatever the hell you like and feel good about yourself, feel morally shored up, because tracking your spending is in itself a responsible thing to do.
But what about giving away all that personal information?
In April, Blippi leaked the credit card numbers of some of its users. Shouldn't shoppers be concerned about their privacy? Yes, says Anthony Lee. He's CEO of startup WeShop.com, an online shopping network. Lee says consumers should be concerned that if they give away their privacy, they're getting something in return.
I think the privacy debate is actually the wrong way around, that the privacy debate shouldn't be about what is being taken. It should be about the value of what's being taken and who's entitled to that value.
Lee says WeShop will let consumers trade directly with retailers, data for deals.
The value of a simple receipt in the hands of a competitor for you is very valuable because it tells the competition, oh, this person is buying such and such, is buying brand A.
Now, brand A's competitors know what kind of, say, orange juice you like and what price you'll pay for it. They can try to steal your business by offering you a better deal. Eric Greenleaf is a professor of marketing at NYU Stern School of Business. He says social shopping networks could change business as usual.
This idea of having a common data set for all the purchases that millions of people are making is really revolutionary. The only firms who can do that right now are credit card companies.
Greenleaf says the new data could make it easier for small businesses to target their customers. I asked him if he thinks the sites will catch on.
Many consumers may not want people to know that they're going to the store to buy something like a laxative, but if they've bought a new car or a new TV or a new camera, they're probably very happy to tell people about it.
And all that bragging about what you buy, that's what sites like Blippi and Swipely.com are counting on. I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, offering total return strategies designed to match your goals. This is Putnam Today. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note today, joy and sadness in Detroit. The good news first. All three American car makers reported double-digit increases in sales last month over a year earlier, although that is not saying a whole lot. Last year at this time, Chrysler was in bankruptcy protection. GM was about to be, but more sales is more sales. One sour note from Detroit, though. Ford confirmed today what we learned last week. Mercury is going to go away at the end of the year after a 71-year run. We are going to go away right now. That's Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow rose 225 points, 2.25%. The NASDAQ packed on 58 points, almost 2.75%. The S&P 500 bulked up 27 points. That is 2.5%. Vahan Baladuni, Ravi Karman, Stephen Colon, Andrea Jackson-Gewirtz, Eric Johnson, Jeff Peters, and Charlton Thorpe engineered the program for us. You can tune in tomorrow to the Marketplace Morning Report for the latest in business and economic news. And coming up next time on this particular radio broadcast, marketing to Hispanics moves beyond the niche.
That sends a message that says, here, this three-foot section is for you, and the rest of the store is for everybody else.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.